Ulysses is divided into three main sections. The first of three chapters, the second of 12, and the third of three. It rests on, as the title tells you, the Odyssey of Odysseus. Now, it was frequently said that Joyce just put this thing together, and this Odyssey gave a kind of structure to a great mass of material. It gives not only a structure, but it anticipates the whole sense. In the Odyssey, Odysseus has been in war for 10 years. And his mentality is the mentality of just a he-man world. And the woman is simply booty. Do you remember the beginning of the Iliad? The problem was, who gets the blonde? Achilles or Agamemnon? And the blonde is Briseis, this captured Trojan young woman. The fury of Achilles, the wrath of Achilles, he retreats to his tent, and he doesn't come out of his tent, get back into the war, until his friend Patroclus is wounded and killed, and then he goes out and comes the conflict with Hector and so forth. Well, after the war, everybody starts home. These are known as the Nastoi, the returns home of the warriors. Menelaus returns home with Helen. That must have been a very pleasant household for a while. And then Agamemnon goes home to Clytemnestra and gets killed. And Odysseus starts home. And they start home in a rather rough way. He has 12 ships. That's his outfit that was fighting at Troy for 10 years. He's been away for 10 years. And his little son had just been born before he left, so the boy is now 10 years old. And the 12 ships go north to a little town called Ismarius, where they ravage the town and rape the women and just behave like a bunch of buccaneers. Well, the gods say this is no way for a man to go home. And so they give him a little bit of an initiation into how it is to go home. The opening of the Trojan War is supposed to have been caused by the judgment of Paris. Remember this languid youth of a kind which in my own youth we used to call a lounge lizard, is to judge the three great goddesses of Greece. Now this is a masculine put down of the goddess. The earlier tradition was of the powerful goddess, and then the patriarchal Indo-Europeans come in and the goddess is put down. Just as in the Bible, the goddess is put down. She's called the abomination, the goddess of the Canaanites and so forth. There's a put down with these three goddesses, and they are Aphrodite, Hera, and Athene. Now, Aphrodite is the goddess, in her special literary aspect, of lust. And she would represent seduction, and sin, let's say, to use a biblical term. Hera is the spouse of Zeus and represents woman as the wife and mother and matriarch. Athene is the young virgin goddess born from Zeus's forehead, her father. He had a pain in his head one day and sent for Hephaestus to crack his head open. And Hephaestus did that job for him, and out jumps Athene, voila, in full armor. Daddy's girl. So these three aspects of the female are the three aspects that are to appear here in Ulysses. Woman as wife, this is Molly. woman as temptress. This is what we get in the brothel. And woman as daughter. Bloom has a little daughter named Millie, Molly and Millie, and she is the Athene, the daughter wife. And so also Odysseus, when he starts home, having ravaged this town, is blown about for 10 days by the gods and gets lost. And his whole fleet of 12 ships is now in dreamland. The first port they put to is that of the Lotus Eaters. And the Lotus Eaters, this is the LSD stuff. From here on, they're in dreamland. And a lot of them don't want to leave, but Odysseus gets it, so they do get on the boats. And that's the crossing into the realm of dream. And then the first encounter after they cross into the realm of dream is with Polyphemus, the Cyclops, with one eye in the middle of his forehead. He's a giant. He's a cannibal. Odysseus goes ashore with 12 men to see what they've got here. They find the cave of the Cyclops. They go into the cave and find pots of milk and curd and butter there, and they think, well, we're in the home of a shepherd. But when the shepherd comes in, he's this great big giant cannibal. And the giant says to Odysseus, who are you? And Odysseus has the wit to say, no man. That's to say, he has divested himself of his secular character when he moves into the dream realm and the realm of the gods. Well, you know what happens. The Cyclops eats half a dozen of the men, and Odysseus feels that this is a serious problem. And with the one of the meals, he offers him some wine that he has been given by the priest of Ismarius. And the Cyclops drinks the wine, goes to sleep, and the men then drive his eye out with a great big beam, and he sits outside the cave. Oh, he hollers then, and the other Cyclops say, well, what's the matter in there? Who's hurting you? And he says, no man. Well, they say, well, then shut up and keep it to yourself. And then he sits outside the cave to get them as they go out, and very important moment, Odysseus has said he is no man. How does he get out of the cave? He takes three sheep, ties them together, places one of his men underneath. There are only six men left. And three sheep go out with one of his men, three more with another, and the Cyclops simply touches the sheep and thinks they're what's going out, and he doesn't realize the men are escaping. And finally, Odysseus gets under the great big ram and is carried out under the ram. Now, the ram at that time, in that part of the world, was the animal symbolic of the solar light, solar power. So Odysseus, having divested himself of his secular character, identifies himself with the solar light, consubstantiality with the sun, and his final adventure, as you know, is in the Isle of the Sun. Well, now, having passed through, this is a very interesting thing, having passed through the threshold, having gone through the narrow gate, the door guardian, the dangerous one. Polyphemus is a son of the Lord Poseidon, the Lord of the abyssal waters, one with Neptune, Poseidon, Neptune, the same god, and so represents the foreground of the power that is going to be initiating Odysseus all the way through. Having gone through this, one could feel, you know, sort of spiritual exaltation. This is known as inflation. And it happens on every ashram. You can see inflation all over the place. And so he turns up next in the island of the god of the winds. And the god of the winds gives him a wallet full of wind, which would carry him home. But the men aboard the ship open the wallet all at once instead of bit by bit and blow the wind, and so now they're deflated. And in the condition of deflation, inflation, deflation, manic depression, they come to the Isle of the Laestrygonians, who are cannibals, and the abyss. They're rowing the 12 boats, and the cannibals smash 11 of their boats, so there's one boat left. And this brings us then to the next great initiation with Circe, the woman who turns men into swine. Well, I won't go through the whole adventure. I mean, this isn't what we're here to talk about. But the first adventure is that he comes up against now is with Circe, the seductress. And she is the nymph counterpart of Aphrodite, the one who was put down by the patriarchal judge, now is the one who has to be faced. And she is the one who introduces him to the two great initiations. Hermes comes to help him, and Hermes says, you're in trouble here, and I'll give you a little piece of a special plant called moly, which will protect you against her magic. And when she comes towards you, you just threaten her with your dirk. She won't be able to hurt you. She'll invite you to her bed, join her in bed, and then she will initiate you to the two great initiations. Now, this is a main theme in many of the myths. The woman who is the seductress, the woman who is the killer, is the one who initiates the hero into the ultimate mysteries. And these mysteries are two. He is sent to the underworld. And in the underworld, he meets Tiresias, this hero who was for 8 years a woman, and so knows both sides of the mystery. Not just the he-man, but man and woman together. This is Stephen's problem. Can I, like Tiresias, become one with the female power? That's Bloom's problem also. And it is the great hero's problem to acquiesce in a dialogue with the female, not the male as dominant, but the male in interaction with a equivalent but different entity. And the second initiation that Circe gives him is to the island of the sun, the Lord of Light. The two initiations, one into the abyss, the biological source, the other to the island of the sun, the illuminating source. And these are the two great initiations of life, and they come from the negative woman. And these are the initiations that are going to come in the brothel to both Bloom and Stephen. Then, after the island of the sun, shipwreck and all that kind of thing, Odysseus spends 8 years on the island with Calypso, and that's the married life, experiencing woman then as the life companion for 8 years. And when he leaves her finally, he comes to the island of little Nausicaa, the little girl, the daughter, and it's from there that he's taken home to his own island, and now he's ready to meet his wife in a proper way. So it is this induction of the male into the mystery of union with the female power, the canceling of ego, self-interest and fixation, and the opening up through compassion, not passion, but compassion. And with that opening, one is open to the world as well as to the female power. This is what Joyce is using as the ground of his book. And the chapters are named after different Odyssey episodes, not in the order in which they occur in the Odyssey. Book one, the first three books, have to do with Telemachus, the son, who is left at home. And by the time his father gets home, after 10 years wandering around, the boy is 20 years old, or 22, which is exactly the age of Stephen here. When Bloom meets Stephen, there is the father-son relationship established, first on Bloom's part and then on Stephen's part. So the first chapter shows Stephen with his three friends in this Martello Tower, cut off from the world of life, just a male situation. Now, this Englishman is a real problem. He has come to Ireland to collect folk tales, to get his degree. Well, as though the English hadn't plundered Ireland enough. He comes in now to plunder them of their folk tales so he can get something out of it. And a little old woman, the milk woman, comes in to deliver the milk in the morning. Buck Mulligan has just slopped out the three eggs, in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sanctus, Amen, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Haynes sits down to pour the tea, and presently then, there's a knock on the door, and in comes this little old woman with the milk. The doorway was darkened by her entering form. This is a sweet little thing. She is in the role here of Athene, who comes to Telemachus when Telemachus is 20-odd years old and says, go find your father. The doorway was darkened by an entering form. The milk, sir. Come in, ma'am, Mulligan said. Kinch, get out the jug. An old woman came forward and stood by Stephen's elbow. That's a lovely morning, sir, she said. Glory be to God. To whom? Said Mulligan, glancing at her. Ah, to be sure. Stephen reached back and took the milk jug from the locker. The islanders, Mulligan said to Haynes casually, speak frequently of the collector of prepuces. This is the God of the Old Testament who collects foreskins. How much, sir? Asked the old woman. A quart, Stephen said. Now, he watched her pour into the measure and thence into the jug rich white milk, not hers, old shrunken paps. She poured again a measureful and a tilly. Old and secret, she had entered from a morning world, maybe a messenger. She praised the goodness of the milk, pouring it out, crouching by a patient cow at daybreak in the lush field, a witch on her toadstool, her wrinkled fingers quick at the squirting dugs. They lowed about her whom they knew, due silky cattle, silk of the kind and poor of the kine, and poor old woman, names given her in old times. She's Mother Ireland, as far as Stephen is thinking. A wandering crone, lowly form of an immortal, serving her conqueror and her gay betrayer, Haynes the conqueror, Mulligan the betrayer, who invited Haynes in, their common cuck queen, a messenger from the secret morning, to serve or to upbraid, whether he could not tell, but scorned to beg her favor. It is indeed, ma'am, Buck Mulligan said, pouring milk into their cups. Taste it, sir, she said. He drank at her bidding. Now, this is the reminder to Stephen that his island had been exploited and wiped out. Mulligan's talking, Haynes starts talking to her, the Englishman, in Gaelic, in Irish. Do you understand what he says? Stephen asked her. Is it French you're talking, sir? The old woman said to Haynes. Haynes spoke to her again, a longer speech, confidently. Irish, Buck Mulligan said. Is there Gaelic on you? I thought it was Irish, she said, by the sound of it. Are you from the West, sir? I'm an Englishman, Haynes answered. He's English, Buck Mulligan said, and he thinks we ought to speak Irish in Ireland. Sure we ought to, the old woman said, and I'm ashamed I don't speak the language myself. I'm told it's a grand language by them it knows. Grand is no name for it, said Buck Mulligan. Wonderful entirely. Fill us out some more tea, Kinch. So Kinch gets the feeling of, you remember he said he was going to fashion in the smithy of his soul the uncreated conscience of his race, and this is his call then to restore, you might say, the Irish spirit to Ireland. So Stephen has been called by the little old woman, and these first three sections speak about the launching of his intention, you might say, walking on the same beach with which he later, as Joyce, would walk with Nora Barnacle. Then comes Leopold Bloom, a totally different man. Mr. Leopold Bloom ate with relish the inner organs of beasts and fowls. He liked thick giblet soup, nutty gizzards, a stuffed roast heart, liver slices fried with crust crumbs, fried hen cod's roes. Most of all, he liked grilled mutton kidneys, which gave to his palate a fine tang of faintly scented urine. Kidneys were in his mind as he moved about the kitchen softly, writing her breakfast things. He's preparing Molly's breakfast. She's upstairs. Preparing her breakfast things on a humpy tray. A gelid light and air were in the kitchen, but out of doors, gentle summer morning everywhere made him feel a bit peckish. The coals were reddening. Another slice of bread and butter, three, four, right. She didn't like her plate full and so forth. He brings the breakfast up to Molly, and over their bed is a picture called The Bath of the Nymph, which he cut from a Sunday section in a popular newspaper and had framed. And this bathing nymph is on his mind. Now, the relationship to Molly has been really basically cut off since the death of their little boy. They have a daughter who's now about 15 years old, and the little boy died about 11 years ago. And I don't know what it must be to have given birth to a child and then have the child die immediately. But in their case, Joyce have known something about this. It had really cut them off in their sexual life together. So that he has not been doing, as we hear later, his husbandly duty in relation to Molly. Now, Molly is a big, buxom singer, and he's nothing of the kind. He's a very plain and honest little man. But she's quite baroque. And as he finds this morning, when he goes out to buy a kidney for himself at a Jewish pork butcher's shop, he comes back and there's a letter for her from her manager, Blazes Boylan, who's going to be visiting her today, and he knows that Blazes is going to be with her all day. And he's just trying to keep that out of his mind and go about his business. There are three chapters about Bloom that overlap in time the three about Stephen that we've just read. And one is this one of getting up in the morning, and it's called Calypso. Now, most of writers about Ulysses think that Molly Bloom is Calypso. She's not Calypso. Calypso is the nymph with whom Odysseus spent 8 years instead of going home to Penelope. Calypso is the nymph over the bed. His mind is not on his Molly there. It's on nymphs. Every woman he sees, he's eyeing her and thinking thoughts about her. And the next chapter, called Lotus Eaters, is one of him just going around Dublin in a vague sort of way. Then we begin to in the part two, which is where we're coming now. We're into part two. In the fourth chapter, we've caught up in time to Stephen. And Bloom is in a sort of carriage with Stephen's father, Simon Dedalus, on the way to a funeral, to the burial of Paddy Dignam. So we're now going to visit the underworld, and this is associated with the underworld journey. I won't do much with this. It's a very amusing and interesting chapter. But we do see Stephen out there, and we're with Simon Dedalus. So this gives Bloom a reason for later on in the day becoming interested in protecting Stephen Dedalus from his own drunken friends. That's the underworld section here. Then Aeolus is the chapter where Bloom meets Stephen. Bloom is soliciting ads, and to solicit ads, he has to go to a newspaper shop. And this is the chapter that's written with headlines imitating newspaper headlines. And there's a lot of gas here. This is the island of the god of the winds. And Stephen passes through, and Bloom passes through, and it's the first time they see each other. And it's a book, actually, of separate little scenes. One could give any one of them, and many of them have been given, as separate literary theatrical productions. Bloom passes through. Then there's the Laestrygonians, the cannibals who broke 11 of Odysseus's ships. Bloom decides he's going to have lunch. Well, he goes from one restaurant to another trying to find one that doesn't turn his stomach. And it's a wonderful chapter of you come out of it all covered with mayonnaise sauce, you might say, and grease. Then Scylla and Charybdis. This is a very amusing chapter, and it's an important one in the book. We go to the library, and Stephen presents a theory that he has about Shakespeare. And since Shakespeare is going to be the father image and Hamlet the son image, the story he presents is of Shakespeare's own son, who is named Hamnet, having died, and Shakespeare having Hamlet as a kind of echo of his own fatherhood, and Shakespeare himself playing the role of Hamlet's father, and Burbage playing the role of Hamlet in one of the early productions. And this business of the father and the son, and the one is the other, and so forth, back and forth. And then he also has a theory that Shakespeare was cuckolded by Anne Hathaway, his wife, and that his brother was one of the people with whom Anne Hathaway was unfaithful. And it's a long story about that, with evidence from Shakespeare's last will, where he wills to Anne Hathaway his second best bed. So this whole business of the father and the son in the way of Hamlet is something that's in his mind here. And we move on from there. These are themes that are in his mind in relation to the giving of himself to the father. It's a chapter that's full of imagery and quotations from the great corpus of Shakespeare's plays. Then comes one of the central chapters of the book, called The Wandering Rocks, and it's just a picture of Dublin in many, many little short images, where Dublin itself becomes the hero. This became a model for a number of works that came out during the 30s and 40s, where a city became the hero. This was the first thing of its kind, I believe, in the history of 20th century literature, and that the city does come up. Then there's the Sirens. This is a bar where Bloom goes, and the men are singing and in a bar, and you get a thoroughly musical show. And then comes the Cyclops, and this is one I want to read, and then we'll have a little break. I just wanted to read part of this. Bloom goes into a store. This is the way Bloom is living. He's just trying to get away from things. He goes into a bar, and there's a great big Irish patriot there, a Sinn Féin, We Ourselves fellows, all for Ireland. And his Bloom, this little Jew, comes in, and he feels that he's quite a foreign person in this place. The story is told by a chap who saw what happened. I was just passing the time of day with old Troy of the DMP, Dublin Mounted Police, at the corner of Arbor Hill there, and be damned but a bloody sweep came along and he near drove his gear into my eye. I turned around to let him have the weight of my tongue when who should I see dodging along Stony Batter only Joe Hines. "Lo, Joe," says I, "how are you blowing? Did you see that old bloody chimney sweep near shoved my eye out with his brush?" "Soot's Lux," says Joe. "Who's the old bollocks you were talking to?" "Old Troy," says I, "was in the force. I'm on two minds not to give that fellow in charge for obstructing the thoroughfare with his brooms and ladders." "What are you doing around these parts?" says Joe. "Devil a much," says I. And he's telling the story then of what he saw in the bar. Now there's a big race going on today, a horse race. And the horse that happens to win the race was a dark horse named Throwaway. And the odds on it were enormous. And Bloom comes into the bar with a newspaper in his hand. And he's going out then to do some job, and then he's coming back into the bar again. And just as he's about to leave the bar, he's asked, "Can I have the paper?" And Bloom says, "Yeah, I was just going to throw it away." And he goes out, and when he comes back, the news is in, the Throwaway has run and won. And Bloom doesn't know anything about this. So he comes back, and people think he went out to collect the bet, and that he's wealthy, and he isn't standing anybody to treats. And the poor guy, he doesn't know why the whole thing's down on his neck. And the big guy starts abusing him for being a Jew, and he says to him one time, "Yes, I'm a Jew, and Jesus is a Jew. Your God is a Jew." Well, this was more than the Irishman could take. And he starts threatening Bloom. And Bloom has to run for his life. And the end is something else. Bloom runs out. Yeah, here we are. "Gob, the devil wouldn't stop until he got hold of the bloody tin anyhow, and out with him." And Bloom's run out on the street, and he's jumped on a passing jaunting car. You know what a jaunting car is? It's an Irish car where instead of sitting facing this way, you're off the side like this. He goes out with the bloody tin, out with him, and little Alf hanging onto his elbows, and he's shouting like a stuck pig, as good as any bloody play in the Queen's Royal Theatre. "Where is he till I murder him?" And Ned and J.G. paralyzed with the laughing. "Bloody wars," says I, "I'll be in for the last gospel." But as luck would have it, the Javi got the nag's head round the other way and off with him. "Hold on, citizen," says Joe. "Stop." Now, this is described in gargantuan terms. "But Gob, he drew his hand and he made a swipe and let fly. Mercy of God, the sun was in his eyes, the Cyclops blinded, or he'd have left him for dead. Gob, he near sent it into the County Longford. The bloody nag took fright, and the old mongrel, there was a dog there, big, great, big dog, after the car like bloody hell, and all the populace shouting and laughing, and the old tin box clattering along the street." The catastrophe was terrific and instantaneous in its effect. The observatory at Dunsink registered in all 11 shocks, all of the fifth grade of Mercalli's scale, and there is no record extant of a similar seismic disturbance in our island since the earthquake of 1534, the year of the rebellion of Silken Thomas. The epicenter appears to have been that part of the metropolis which constitutes the Inns Quay Ward and the parish of St. McCann, covering a surface of 41 acres, two roads, and one square pole or perch. All the lordly residences in the vicinity of the Palace of Justice were demolished, and that noble edifice itself, in which at the time of the catastrophe important legal debates were in progress, is literally a mass of ruins beneath which it is to be feared all occupants have been buried alive. From the reports of eyewitnesses, it transpires that the seismic waves were accompanied by a violent atmospheric perturbance of cyclonic character. An article of headgear since ascertained to belong to the much respected clerk of the Crown and Peace, Mr. George Fottrell, and a silk umbrella with gold handle with engraved initials, coat of arms, and house number of the erudite and worshipful chairman of Quarter Sessions, Sir Frederick Faulkner, Recorder of Dublin, have been discovered by search parties in remote parts of the island, respectively the former on the third basaltic ridge of the Giant's Causeway, the latter embedded to the extent of 1 foot 3 inches in the sandy beach of Hull Open Bay near the old head of Kinsale. Other eyewitnesses deposed that they observed an incandescent object of enormous proportions hurtling through the atmosphere at a terrifying velocity in a trajectory directed southwest by west. Messages of condolence and sympathy are being hourly received from all parts of the different continents, and the Sovereign Pontiff has been graciously pleased to decree that a special Missa pro defunctis shall be celebrated simultaneously by the ordinaries of each and every cathedral church of all the episcopal dioceses subject to the spiritual authority of the Holy See, in suffrage of the souls of those faithful departed who have been so unexpectedly called away from our midst. The work of salvage, removal of debris, human remains, and so forth has been entrusted to Messrs. Michael Mead and Son, 159 Green Brunswick Street, and Messrs. T.C. Martin, 77, 78, 79, and 80 North Wall, assisted by the men and officers of the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry, under the general supervision of His Royal Highness Rear Admiral the Right Honorable Sir Hercules Hannibal Hobbius Corpus Anderson, KG, KP, KT, PC, KCB, MPJ, P, M, B, D, S, O, S, O, D, M, F, H, M, R, I, A, B, I, Musical Doctor, P, L, G, F, G, C, D, F, R, U, I, F, R, C, P, I, and F, R, C, S, I. You never saw the like of it in all your born puff. Job, if he got that lottery ticket on the side of his pal, he'd remember the gold cup, he would so. But begob, the citizen would have been lugged for assault and battery, and Joe for aiding and abetting. The Jarvie saved his life by furious driving, as sure as God made Moses. What? Oh, Jesus, he did. And he led a volley of oaths after him. Did I kill him, says he, or what? And he shouting to the bloody dog, after him, Gary, after him, boy. And the last we saw was the bloody car rounding the corner, and old Sheep's face on it gesticulating, and the bloody mongrel after it with his lugs back for all he was bloody well worth to tear him limb from limb. 100 to 5, Jesus, he took the value of it out of him, I promise you. When lo, there came about them all a great brightness, and they beheld the chariot wherein he stood ascend to heaven, and they beheld him in the chariot, clothed upon in the glory of the brightness, having raiment as of the sun, fair as the moon, and terrible, that for awe they durst not look upon him. And there came a voice out of heaven calling, Elijah, Elijah. And he answered with a main cry, Abba, Adonai. And they beheld him, even him, Ben Bloom, Elijah, amid clouds of angels ascend to the glory of the brightness at an angle of 45 degrees over Donahue's and Little Green Street like a shot off a shovel. Isn't that a show? Gargantuan. The Cyclops and the whole thing is that way. You go rocking back and forth from one of these to another. Then comes a totally different world. Now, I told you that the style, Joyce's style, was in the mood of the day, the time of the day, and the people being dealt with and so forth. Bloom, he just goes down to a beach, you know, and so he's going to sit down on a beach. Well, there are some little girls there with a little baby, and they're taking care of the little baby, and Bloom's looking at the girls. And then up on a ridge back of the beach is a little church where there's a men's retreat, and they're singing hymns to the Virgin. These are the men's voices singing to the Virgin. It is Bloom down here on the beach after this affair with the Cyclops looking at this little girl. But I just want to give you a sense of the change of style. We've just finished what I've just read to you, and now we have, this is the style of a little cheap popular magazine. Sentimental magazine. The summer evening had begun to fold the world in its mysterious embrace. Far away in the west, the sun was setting, and the last glow of all too fleeting day lingered lovingly on sea and strand, on the proud promontory of dear old Hoth, guarding as ever the waters of the bay, on the weed-grown rocks along Sandy Mount shore, and, last but not least, on the quiet church, whence there streamed forth at times upon the stillness the voice of prayer to her who is in her pure radiance a beacon ever to the storm-tossed heart of man, Mary, Star of the Sea. The three girlfriends were seated on the rocks, enjoying the evening scene and the air, which was fresh but not too chilly. Many a time and oft were they wont to come there to their favorite nook to have a cozy chat beside the sparkling waves and discuss matters feminine. Sissy Caffrey, Edie Boardman with the baby in the push car, and Tommy and Jackie Caffrey, two little curly-headed boys dressed in sailor suits with caps to match and the name HMS Belle Isle printed on both. For Tommy and Jackie Caffrey were twins, scarce 4 years old, and very noisy and spoiled twins sometimes, but for all that, darling little fellows with bright, merry faces and endearing ways about them. They were dabbling in the sand with their spades and buckets, building castles as children do, or playing with their big red-colored ball, happy as the day was long. And Edie Boardman was rocking the chubby baby to and fro in the push car, while that young gentleman fairly chuckled with delight. He was but 11 months and 9 days old, and though still a tiny toddler, was just beginning to lisp his first babyish words. Sissy Caffrey bent over him to tease his fat little plucks and the dainty dimple in his chin. "Now, baby," Sissy Caffrey said, "say it out big, big. I want a drink of water." The baby prattled after her, "a jink, a jink, a jawbo," and so on. And Bloom is there, just sitting, watching this thing, thinking about this little girl. And he thinks about her in such a way that he finally has an orgasm. And after that, she gets off and walks away, and he sees that she is lame. Well, that's that chapter. Then we come, I hope you enjoyed this. Then we come to the biggie, the Oxen of the Sun. This is the island of the Lord of the Sun, who is the Lord of Generation and so forth, and it is the maternity chapter where this woman is having trouble giving birth, and the students have come and they're sitting around. I just want to do something about this and then break off, and I'm going to save the finish in the big brothels chapter, which is tremendously important for tomorrow morning as a separate event. We are in this hospital, but it starts with an old Celtic charm, Deshill. Deshill means let's go in the sunwise turn direction, Hollis. Let us go to Hollis Street, which is where the hospital is, Aeamus, let us go. Deshill Homus Aeamus, Deshill Hollis Aeamus, Deshill Hollis Aeamus. Send us, bright one, light one, whore horn, quickening and womb fruit. Send us, bright one, light one, whore horn, quickening and womb fruit. Send us, bright one, light one, whore horn, quickening and womb fruit. Hoopsa, boy a boy, hoopsa, hoopsa, boy a boy, hoopsa, hoopsa, boy a boy, hoopsa. And then that sentence that I read before, universally, that person's a cumin, and so forth. And we move gradually into this chapter. Bloom comes to the door, loath to irk in Horn's Hall, hat holding, the seeker stood. It's Bloom at the door. The door has been opened by a nurse, a woman whom he knows. On her stove he e'er was living with dear wife. He and his wife had once lived with this woman who has opened the door to him, with his dear wife and lovesome daughter, that then over land and sea floor 9 years had long wandered. He hadn't seen her for 9 years. Once her on town hythe meeting, he to her bow had not doffed. He once hadn't tipped his hat to her bow. Her to forgive now he craved, with good ground of her allowed, that to him swift-seen face hers so young then had looked. Well, he knows how to get out of things. Light, swift, her eyes kindled, bloom of blushes, his word winning. As her eyes on got his weeds swart, he was dressed in black because he had gone to Paddy Dignam's funeral. Therefore sorrow she feared, glad after she was, that e'er a dread was. Well, he told her everything's okay. Her he asked if O'Hare doctor tidings sent from far coast, and she was gramful sigh, him answered that O'Hare doctor in heaven was. So a doctor whom he thought to meet here had died. Sad was the man that word to hear, that him so heaved in bowels ruthful. All she there told him, ruing death for friends so young, all gates saw unwilling, God's right wish, got right wiseness to withsay. God's ways are not our ways, and it's too bad such a young man should die. So he comes in, and then he hears these young men talking and being really very rude and rough about the whole business of birth and conception and so forth. And Bloom, with his respect for woman and thinking of Molly and the loss of their child and so forth, is really deeply touched by this in a sorrowful way. And then Stephen starts to make a lot of statements that seem like blasphemy of one kind or another, and the black crack of noise in the street takes place, and Bloom then turns to comfort Stephen. Master Madden, being godly certain whiles, knocked Stephen on his ribs upon that crack of doom, and Master Bloom, at the braggart's side, spoke to him calming words to slumber his great fear, advertising how it was no other thing but a hubbub noise that he heard, the discharge of fluid from the thunderhead, look you, having taken place, and all of the order of a natural phenomenon. But was young Boasthard's fear vanquished by calmer's words? No, for he had in his bosom a spike named bitterness, which could not by words be done away. And was he then neither calm like the one nor godly like the other? He was neither as much as he would have liked to be either. But could he not have endeavored to have found again, as in his youth, the bottle holiness that then he lived withal? Indeed not, for grace was not there to find that bottle. Heard he then in that clap the voice of God bring forth, or, what Karma said, a hubbub, a phenomenon? Heard? Why, he could not but hear, unless he had plugged up the tube, understanding which he had not done. For through that tube he saw that he was in the land of phenomenon, where he must for a certain one day die, as he was like the rest too, a passing show. And would he not accept to die like the rest and pass away? By no means would he, and make more shows according as men do with wives, which phenomenon has commanded them to do by the book of the law. And so this thing goes on and on and on and on. And finally, the child is born, and we come to, by this time, we've reached the style of Dickens. This is one of my favorite paragraphs. Meanwhile, the skill and patience of the physician had brought about a happy accouchement. It had been a weary, weary while, both for patient and doctor. All that surgical skill could do was done, and the brave woman had manfully helped. She had. She had fought the good fight, and now she was very, very happy. Those who have passed on, who have gone before, are happy too as they gaze down and smile upon the touching scene. Reverently look at her as she reclines there with the mother light in her eyes, that longing hunger for baby fingers. A pretty sight it is to see in the first bloom of her new motherhood, breathing a silent prayer of thanksgiving to one above, the universal husband. And as her loving eyes behold her babe, she wishes only one blessing more, to have her dear Dodie there with her to share her joy, to lay in his arms that mite of God's clay, the fruit of their lawful embraces. He is older now, you and I may whisper it, and a trifle stooped in the shoulders, yet in the whirligig of years a grave dignity has come to the conscientious second accountant of the Ulster Bank, College Green Branch. Oh, Dodie, loved one of old, faithful life mate now, it may never be again that far-off time of the roses. With the old shake of her pretty head, she recalls those days. God, how beautiful now across the mist of years. But their children are grouped about her in imagination, about the bedside, hers and his. Charlie, Mary Alice, Frederick Albert, if he had lived, Mamie, Budgie, Victoria Frances, Tom, Violet Constance Louisa, darling little Bobsy, called after our famous hero of the South African War, Lord Bobs of Waterford and Kandahar, and now this last pledge of their union, a Purefoy if there ever was one, with the true Purefoy nose. Young hopeful will be christened Mortimer Edward, after the influential third cousin of Mr. Purefoy in the Treasury Remembrances Office, Dublin Castle. And so time wags on, but Father Cronion has dealt lightly here. Whole, let no sigh break from that bosom, dear, gentle Mina. And Dodie, knock the ashes from your pipe, the seasoned briar you still fancy when the curfew rings for you, may it be the distant day, and doubt the light whereby you read in the sacred book, for the oil too has run low, and so with a tranquil heart to bed to rest. He knows and will call in his own good time. You too have fought the good fight and played loyally your man's part. Sir, to you my hand. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. So that the child is born. And imitating writers of the late 19th century, right on up to his own time, Joyce brings the language right up to the present moment. And with the birth of the child and the news of the birth, all the young doctors and medical students go bursting out of the building. There's a fire brigade that's going down the street. And Lynch and Stephen, Lynch is his sort of friend who's with him in all these occasions, go down to the brothels for the rest of the night. So we go from the maternity hospital to the brothels and the great mother goddess in her two aspects, one as the giver of birth and the other as the giver of spiritual rebirth through temptation and illumination, which is what comes, are going to be in the latter part of this chapter. Now the brothels chapter is about one quarter or one fifth the length of the book. This is it, and I want to deal with it tomorrow at some of the main things.
Swapped rings of each other. father's hands. Surely against my will, mine was of the beaten gold, yours but black tin. Yes, mine was of the
but black tin.